Senate Committee on Health Policy and Public Affairs to order. It is Monday, April 23rd. Welcome, everybody. And I think, colleagues, we don't have amendments for Senate Bill 948 or 717, but I ask the drafters of the amendments to speak to the changes that are going to be made so the committee has an idea so they can start thinking about it. But right now I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 791. And Shannon, tell us where we are on that one.
Senate Bill 791 creates a 24-member task force on mental health and addiction services for underserved populations. We brought back an amendment last week which had racial or ethnic populations, and the dash 2 amendment in your packet has the correct language, racial and ethnic populations. And so, okay. Should be ready to go.
This one's really ready to go, but Ann Taylor, I'd like to ask her to come up. She has a story to tell, and we were not able to work her in the last time around, and so I think it would be very appropriate for her to come up and tell us her story. And this bill does, it is a task force. Ann, come on up and sit right there. And it's for mental health and addiction services for underserved populations. And I think your story might be pertinent for this.
Thank you very much.
And introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Ann Taylor, and I don't know, can you hear me okay?
Pull it in front of you.
Pull it in front of me, okay. I can speak up too. Boy, I don't know where to begin. I don't know what this bill is about, but...
So, on mental health.
I have been diagnosed with schizophrenia, but before that, I worked at a workplace, and it was an OSHA complaint where I was exposed to a bunch of welding fumes, and they think I was probably... But they didn't go in until 88. This happened in 85. I was basically not cared for 6 years, and I found my own peace, my own way by using natural supplements to get my brain and my emotions back in control. I probably was exposed to, I was exposed to manganese, which is a heavy metal, and it causes basal ganglion damage. And my fear is that they will force me on schizophrenic drugs at some point because they trump everything up. I was tortured in the Marion County Jail. A strap was put over my nose so I could not breathe out of it, and I was trying to breathe through fine mesh covering that they put on what they call a spit shield. I was strapped to a chair, but before that I was tipped over upside down. Handcuffed was grinding into my right hand because I caught myself with my arm, you know. And I was angry, yes, because the Social Security office is wanting to change my reality. They were forcing me to sign a paper I didn't want to sign. I wanted to see a lawyer. I demanded to see a lawyer. At no time was I violent or threatening anybody. But I was accused of that. There was people coming from downstairs talking a long time before I was taken into custody. And I was put in isolation. No one was contacted. I never saw a lawyer. To this day, I've never seen a lawyer, although I've contacted numerous ones. But, you know, I am treated subhumanly, and I am afraid for my safety every time I leave the door, because if someone confronts me, I'm highly profiled. And if someone confronts me, I'm usually arrested. And I have... probably arthritis in my neck. My neck creaks really bad. I was also battered at the workplace. The employer threw a piece of equipment on top of me that could have killed me right there. I'm a survivor. I'm tough as nails, and I'm angry as all get out. But I've never, except I'll take it back, when I was what you would call, I thought it was dementia, but it's really delirium when you're, you know, under the influence of some kind of or you've had some kind of mental injury, you know, to your brain. You have a delirium, and I hallucinated briefly where I saw police cars, not a police car, but another kind of car, a big black or brown car. You know, it wasn't a police car. And I, when a cop grabbed me, I fought for my life. I thought I kicked him, you know, in self-defense.
But Ms. Taylor,
and that happened like in 85.
And was this in the when in the jail system? That were you actually in the in jail for a period of time?
No, okay. That was the thing. See, I was arrested, and they did this prior to booking me, and they put me in a cell. And they put me in a chair first, and then they you know had my hands in back, and they were yanking up on them and pushing me forward, and that's what's killed the man that was on meth. See, if you have the spit hood on. It's like a fine mesh. It's a little coarser than a nylon stocking. I mean, you know, you can get air in it, but if you vomit, if you cough and put mucus on it, you would not be able to breathe through it, especially when they shut off your nose.
So so they didn't put you in, they arrested you. And then where did they send you afterwards?
They released me afterwards.
Just on your own?
Yeah, and then nope. Later, these two cops come to my door and knock on my door, and I refuse to answer the door. I speak through a window. I have a window that you can crank open. And they said they wanted to know if I was a threat. I was going to threaten the Social Security office. And I said, no, I have right here a letter I wrote to them explaining why I couldn't sign a paper. It was a dispute over paperwork and whether I would continue to get benefits. And they threatened to cut me off of disability, you know, SSD entirely, you know. And, you know, I never wanted a handout. I wanted justice. I think I'd been badly mistreated, and my medical conditions are malpractice, you know, and OSHA was negligent. Another man has died in that place that I know of from cancers. Cancers were common. Nobody would have been able to have, if they'd done an IQ test on someone before and after, IQ scores would have dropped dramatically. It causes, you know, brain damage working there. And, you know, now it's improved. Now OSHA's on it. But it took several years to get them to act, and I have paperwork where they were denied entry and they didn't pursue it. And I was told they didn't, and I don't think they've improved much, handle crisis very well in this community. And someone like me that's had experience, or someone that's been in a war or something, maybe we'd be valuable actually working in some of these capacities to kind of oversee some things. Because it takes too long to get, and each case is individual. I mean, no one is exactly has the same kind of trauma, and they want to put these labels on people without knowing their backgrounds. And that's what is dangerous. It's medically dangerous.
Thank you so much, Ms. Taylor. And I want you to know that we, the bills that we have, they're called ombudsman bills, and we're sending several, and we have sent several to Ways and Means, because we're truly trying to reform the mental health system so that when people like you all of a sudden are basically put all by yourself to try to cope with the system and work with the system, you truly need to have an advocate for you. And so we are, this particular bill that we're sending to Ways and Means, it's going to create a task force, and I believe on the task force they are going to have consumers, and a consumer would be someone like you who can tell their story so that we can develop a plan, a good plan that's going to help help people like you in when you get into situations like you did. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for allowing me to speak, Senator Moines Anderson, and thank you very much, and I'll be happy to assist any way I can.
Thank you very much. All right, members, we have Senate Bill 791 before us, and it is a referral to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 791.
Is that the correct
yes.
amendments? Okay. Senator Gordley moves the -2s to Senate Bill 791. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. Mark, Senator Courtney is excused.
And Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 791 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you. Senator Gordley.
Is this going to full Ways and Means or the Human Services?
To full Ways and Means.
Full Ways and Means.
Senator Gordley moves Senate Bill 791 as amended to the full Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered, and Mark Senator Courtney as excused. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 791, and I'd like to open the work session on Senate Bill 958. And colleagues, I don't know if you remember this bill, but Shannon and I were talking about the fee structure on the in-home care registry system. And we, there was a misunderstanding. We thought we would make all the fees $750. That, at least that's how Shannon and I interpreted it. But then someone else said, no, the initial application fee would be $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just wondering what the wishes of this. The way the amendment is it would be $750.
You know what made sense to me, Madam Chair? The night we had these meetings, and there was a guy from some part of rural Oregon who said that he felt anybody coming in for the first time should have to pay the $1,500 fee, and so that they wouldn't have to subsidize them in the event something goes wrong with their money, the assets, and that it made sense to him that the initial fee should be a higher fee than the other fees, but they're already in the business, they should not have to pay those higher fees, and I really kind of support that.
Okay. Is there anyone else who has wishes? Because we certainly can bring this bill back on Wednesday with the $1,500 application fee. Yes.
Madam Chair, if I remember correctly, it was Grant Higginson that suggested the $750.
Yeah, it was.
And I guess because they are the regulatory agency, and that was his preference, I would tend to lean that direction.
Actually, he was the one that brought it to our attention that he thought it was the $1,500. And I don't think he's here. Shannon, can
no,
you?
No.
He was the
$750.
It was the people in the field, it was the providers who thought that the initial fee, because they've seen people who come in and didn't have enough money for their startup business, and then they go out of business, which doesn't do the businesses any good whatsoever. So that's why I said I am for the startup fee, because it helps providers to secure their position, and they don't have to pay the higher fees because they've already paid that stuff.
Thank you, Senator Curtin.
And so part of the confusion was this discussion. The department said it would be easier to have the $750 across the board, so
right,
they didn't have to determine who was,
thank you,
you know, who was initial applicant, who was renewing their license. And on Wednesday morning, I got an email from Dr. Higginson, and he had the $1,500 initial, followed by the $750 follow-up. So hence the confusion. At the will of the committee.
So he was before it, before he was against it. Okay.
Is there a preference on from Senator Courtney or Senator Gordley on?
I wasn't present for the testimony.
Okay.
I'm just going to defer to good Senator Carter.
Okay. I just remember $1,500, and I remember May going back to Shell.
And what going back
to? They going back to Shell.
So I can comment on that as well.
Okay.
Legislative Council uses May and Shell. It's in Oregon statute that they mean the same thing, and they use May when it's followed by not. So in the negative, it's may not, and positive is shall.
Okay.
So they won't change that.
Thanks,
so they won't change the shall.
No.
They will.
Okay. I support the providers. I think that they are in the field and they know better.
I need to know where the votes are. We're in work session.
15.
All right.
Well,
you asked me.
Thank you.
You know, I, Madam Chair, I didn't get the email. I know what Grant said. at the hearing, and I'm trying to remember anybody who is advocating any... I'm trying to remember who is advocating for the 15, and if it was anybody other than those already established. And
well, as Shannon said, Dr. Higginson did indicate 750 at the beginning, but then the subsequent referral or email stated that he would be able to support the 15. It made sense because that is what the providers wanted.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Shannon, do you remember where the gentleman that spoke, where did he come from?
I won't remember offhand, but I probably have... I believe it was Ray Hobazal from Adventist Personal Care, and that was the person who was talking about. He was the provider who mentioned that 1500 seems fair as an initial applicant.
Right. I'm a yes. Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 9.
Wait, we have some amendments here.
Okay.
This is 717. These came after.
No, that's not it.
Oh,
do we have the amendment?
It's attached to.
Okay. This
the dash three.
It's the dash three.
The dash three is the 750.
The dash three has also.
Oh, so we will need to bring it back. All right. We're going to bring this back. Shannon, will you work with Ways and Means to change that initial one? And that way it'll give you time and we'll get something on the record from Dr. Higginson. And
so my understanding is that the wishes of the committee is to change line 6 in the dash 3 amendment from 750 to 1500 for the initial applicant. Okay.
Yes. All right. With that, I'll close the work session on 958. And I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 948. And, committee, we will not be, we don't have the amendments back on this bill, but I ask the writers of the amendment to come up and at least let us know in concept what the amendments say and how it changes the bill.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Marie Kreider from SEIU, and we have been working with council to develop amendments following a meeting with a number of interested parties, some of which we were not able to agree to a set of amendments, but we have worked extensively with DHS and with the skilled nursing intermediate care folks to make sure that we had a set of amendments that they were comfortable with. The intent of the bill, the general purpose and thrust of the bill, would be unchanged under the amendments. It remains to create a framework for local planning that would inform the certificate of need process, to bring the criteria for review of certificate of need applications into the statute itself rather than into the rule, and to explicitly include factors such as quality of health care that were not in the rule into the criteria, to include specifically in the criteria consideration of health care needs of the community, so that we're not just saying it's the certificate of need process is not simply one of saying no to things, but is rather a process of encouraging new facilities to include what we need and expanding the services and facilities that are covered by the statute. Now, let me go through the purpose of the amendments and what they will do. And if you want me to actually look at it line by line, I can try to do that, although whether council drafted exactly as we anticipate, I don't know. But we intended to make sure by the amendments that there are no changes with respect to the law governing intermediate care and skilled nursing facilities. That Section 5 of the bill, it actually did make some changes that were not our intention. And so what we will do in Section 5 in the amendments is to make sure that the old language returns to the bill with respect to those facilities. Secondly, the amendments will address the enforcement processes with respect to hospitals and HMOs. There were some changes made in the bill, and there was a separate Section 2 Section 2 addressed of the bill addressed enforcement generally with respect to hospitals and HMOs. And then Section 3 of the bill, subsection 7, which is on page 6, line 17, there was a set of enforcement rules that applied only to HMOs. What the amendments will do is to create a single enforcement section in Section 2, applicable to both HMOs and hospitals, and the rules will be the same for the two. In the original bill, the director was empowered to revoke the certificate of need, and that power exists in current statute, but only where the certificate of need was obtained by fraud or deceit. We will return to that standard.
So which part is that?
This is in Section 3, subsection 7, which is page 6, line 21. You'll see the director may revoke the certificate or maintain a civil action to enforce compliance. So the concept which we will return to is one that says revocation is only appropriate where the certificate of need was procured by fraud or deceit, and the director may maintain a civil action to enforce the terms of the certificate of need. And the new provision, which will apply to both HMOs and hospitals, is the explicit power to maintain a civil action to enforce conditions imposed as a part of the grant of a certificate of need. And the example that I am most familiar with is the condition imposed on the certificate of need for Kaiser's Westside Hospital, which is a condition that requires that they publicize the availability of their emergency facilities to everyone in the community, regardless of whether or not they are members of Kaiser. That is simply an example of a condition that could be imposed, and the statute, the amendments would preserve that ability of DHS to enforce conditions with respect not only to HMOs but to hospitals as well. The amendments will also retool the appeals process, the hearings and appeals process for certificate of needs for hospitals. Right now we have the certificate of needs statute uses language that's quite different from an ordinary Administrative Procedure Act process. The intention is to go to more standard language, but still to allow the department to use an informal hearings process as an inexpensive and quick way of trying to raise and resolve issues in advance of forcing folks to go to a contested case hearing, which
Madam
is a more
Chair?
Expensive
yes.
process.
Senator Gordley.
Is that the language on page 3? Starting on line 3.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, page 3, line 3 does establish a new process, the amendments will change that somewhat to allow the use of the informal process, but nevertheless to include some timelines that move the process along. I can walk through what I believe the amendments will say about that process if you would like.
Yes.
So in a certificate of need process, the first step is a submission by the applicant of a letter of intent, and that enables which is a very brief description of the project and allows DHS to make a ruling on whether or not the certificate of need law actually applies to that, or whether just to clarify that question. That will remain unchanged in the bill and in the amendments. Then the next step is that the applicant files the detailed application that is required, and that also is unchanged. Much of the procedure is now in rule rather than in statute, so the timelines for processing a certificate of need are in rule rather than in statute. This would bring the timelines. The bill and the amendments will bring the timelines into the statute. The bill requires there to be a public hearing, which is modeled on the process used by the Health Services Commission, where they go out and proactively try to get community input on an application, rather than simply sending a notice to the industry or the other folks that are typically informed of these kinds of things. So a public hearing, that's a new thing. It's in the bill. And it's in the original bill. Yes?
Right now, the certificate of need, there's no public hearing then?
There is, Jen, often a public hearing held in two kinds of ways. One is that there is a provision for an informal hearing, which takes place, I believe, after a proposed decision is arrived at. And so if someone asks for it, then there will be some kind of an informal hearing. But this says, the bill says, and this is the change, is that in every case, DHS should go out to the community and seek input in an informal kind of way. So what the amendments do is say that after that informal gathering of public input, then the department will issue and I'm not sure what the language is going to be on this, but some kind of a proposed draft order that goes out. And then folks can ask for an informal conference or hearing where they can raise issues without going to a formal APA contested case hearing. So that is where the amendments are going to bring in a change.
I'm confused.
Yes.
You're going to have the
Sorry.
Public hearing. You have the letter of intent. You have the detailed application.
Right.
You have the public hearing. And then how does this contested?
You have the public hearing. Then DHS, within 60 days of the public hearing, will issue a draft or proposed order of some sort. Then if an interested party, as defined in the bill, asks for an informal hearing, then that will be promptly convened and folks can raise issues about the draft order. Then within 10 days of that informal hearing, this is the amendments that I'm talking about, the DHS can revise that draft order and put out a proposed order, which is APA terminology. That proposed order then triggers a 30-day period for a request for a contested case hearing, and that is the very formal evidentiary hearing that interested parties would be entitled to have, or an applicant, of course, if the proposed order was to deny the application.
And describe to us again, this applies only to hospitals and expansion of hospitals. Explain exactly how this would affect hospitals now. The changes. You say expansion, you know,
Madam Chair,
I need that defined
of the committee,
for me.
You want me to address the what services and facilities are covered in the bill? I'm describing the bill. The amendments would make no change from the original bill in that regard. So, whereas currently it is new hospitals only that are covered, so right now. So, for example, when a hospital decides that its facility is old and it's going to replace the entire thing, that does not currently require a certificate of need. If the hospital proposes as...
I don't need to know what
Okay.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, my apologies. What the bill will include is relocations of hospitals, new services at hospitals. So, for example, if you didn't have a burn center before and you're going to add a burn center, you didn't have an emergency department, you're going to add an emergency department. You did not do open heart surgery, you're going to do that now. That would be covered.
Does it include expanding imaging?
It includes expanding the scope and type of services. So if there was I realize that is to some extent vague, and the department will have to define and rule exactly what is sufficient to be a new type of service. Is simply the next most sophisticated type of CT scanner really a change in type and scope, or is it something that you can do within the existing? That is a line that we didn't try to draw in the bill very tightly because we think that would be a many, many, many page bill. But if you're changing the type and scope of services, or if you are expanding the bed capacity of a hospital.
What about a healing garden? Or some education, say they really want to have focus on asthma and asthma training, education there, or diabetes, they wanted to really start. Would those types of things also be included?
Madam Chair, I would think not.
Okay. Thank you very much. This helps me.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
The bill has an emergency clause. We have a letter. I'm assuming that other members of the committee have this letter from Providence Health System dated April 2nd. It is from Richard Kagan, Chief Administrative and Strategic Officer, Providence Health System. And he writes in the second paragraph, the direct implications of this bill would be to delay or stop all improvements and growth at hospitals around the state. Can you speak to that point?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, one of the things that we attempted to do in Section 7 of the original bill was to try to make sure that we phased in the application of this so that projects that were in process did not get ambushed by a new process when they were already in process of doing an expansion or a development of a new program. We don't think that Section 7 on page 7 is a perfectly does that, and so the amendments will address the applicability. So in two ways. One is the amendments will say that if you already have the permits necessary for a new development, that the changes do not apply. So that if you had no reason to believe that a certificate of need was going to be necessary for your project, you've got all the permits, but you're in process, you haven't opened the facility yet, the bill would not apply mm-hmm. to you. And secondly, existing law says that the law at the time of the filing of the letter of intent is what governs, and that we'll have a minor change in that, but basically we think that protects other hospitals, such as ones that have applied or are in the process, from having to deal with a whole new set of rules.
Follow up, Madam Chair. When we heard this bill last, I believe, Ms. Kreider, that did you bring forward the matrix? Or was that
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I think that I referred to it and the Hospital Association referred to it also.
In the new draft of this matrix, it appears that the ranking, the Oregon ranking, moves from 2.4 up to 22.8. You've seen this?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, I think the document that you're referring to, and I have more copies if there are members of the committee that don't have it, is a document that was prepared by my staff in consultation with Tom Piper, the man who actually creates these matrices every year. And we showed the how he indicated he would change Oregon's ranking based on a read of the bill.
And Tom Piper, again, is his expertise is what?
Tom Piper is the former, I believe, chair of the American Health Planning Association and director of the Certificate of Need program in the state of Missouri.
Okay.
He actually testified to this committee a couple of years ago.
And so the dots that we now see on that line, the Oregon line, are dots that reflect his reading of the bill.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, I guess a question for you at this point. How many work group meetings were there after the initial one? Because I didn't get notice of them.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, there was only one work group meeting, and I believe that you were there for at least part of that, and I think the sense was that we didn't have a consensus on a direction.
So basically, Madam Chair, this is just SEIU's amendments and SEIU's bill. Okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, there are a couple of more points I should probably make in walking through the amendments that we expect to come out. You will, at page, there is a section of the bill. I'm looking for where it is precisely, which creates the community health planning process, and it's at page 2, beginning at line 14. And you will recall in my testimony that I indicated that our intention was to ask DHS to create the framework for this planning process, including guidelines for planning processes and creating designating healthcare planning regions. but to allow the communities themselves to own the planning process and to do it only if they chose to do it, so to have it be a voluntary community planning process. That required that we have some amendments to this section of the bill, so that whereas the bill actually gives DHS the responsibility of doing health care needs assessments for communities, the amendments will eliminate that responsibility of DHS. And
so you're saying the
the communities would do both the needs assessment and planning. Doing that under, you know, using the processes, the guidelines, the framework created by DHS.
So like Metro does the regional planning for urban growth boundary, another entity would do the same for needs health needs assessments. I mean, are you looking at
Madam Chair, type level? Senator Montes-Anderson, I think that's right. I mean, what DHS will have to do is say, what is the sort of catchment area for healthcare facilities in particular areas of the state? Is it multiple counties? Is it less than a county? What is the appropriate size to go on? And then once they've designated that, then the municipalities would pick up the ball and say, yes, we'd like to do planning, and so we're going to initiate this planning process. Or the municipalities could say,
wow,
no, we don't have the resources to do this. We don't have the, we don't believe it's necessary, whatever, and make a decision whether to engage that process or not.
You know that Senate Bill 329, we've been working so hard on health care reform and setting up a health care trust to really look at overall health care reform. And I'm trying to get my hands around how this would fit into our goals to have, you know, how this would fit into our overall healthcare reform, because we're being pretty prescriptive and letting an entity here decide community assessments, which, I think that's, we need to have that input. But the fact that those recommendations would override maybe other recommendations, either DHS or this new entity that we're that we might be forming for overall health care reform, I sort of want to know how you envision that, or have you even thought about it?
Chair Montes-Anderson, what the processes in this bill would do would be to inform the CON process. They don't have the power at the local level under the bill to actually make decisions. I think in the same way, local planning processes would help to inform the 329 kind of process in a couple of ways. One is it would identify, it would be a way of identifying whether the insurance programs or the health plans were actually providing the services that were needed in the community. And it might inform some experimentation in better kinds of more cost-effective and delivery systems, particularly of primary care. But, you know, that's just sort of, I think it has the potential for doing that.
I think originally, and I cannot remember, that there was certificate of need was in Senate Bill 329, but I don't know if it's been taken out or not. It's been taken out? Dr. Smith, I just am very hesitant to want to move anything until we've really looked at the where we stand on other things that are happening.
Maybe the 329.
Introduce yourself.
Janine Smith, Office of Health Policy and Research, and answer to your question. I think the last amendments took CON as far as being moved as an entity out of DHS and into the health board was removed. I think the subcommittees were given direction to look at certificate, you know, at that sort of thing when looking at the delivery system and planning processes, and then perhaps later decide if CON would come into the trust fund board.
Thank you.
All right.
question.
Yes, Senator Carter.
Can you tell me why surgery centers were left out?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Carter, surgery centers were left out of this bill for two reasons. It's a big step that we're taking with the bill, and I think the sense was that unless there was a consensus of what a broad bill would look like, that it was simply too much to do in one step. So the most important step seemed to be hospitals, because that is where the bulk of the investment in new technology and new facilities is occurring.
Follow-up question. What do you say to those people like Providence Hospitals who feel as if you did not address in this ongoing projects that could be affected by this bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I think that we are going to be able to accomplish that in the new amendments. Mm-hmm. I would urge them to look at the new amendments, and because this is something that we've struggled to try to figure out what the right language is, and we may or may not have got it perfect, but I think we can get there.
Follow-up. Mm-hmm. In the event this bill is successful, how do you see it helping uninsured Oregonians?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I think it does it in a couple of ways. It hopefully will make health care less expensive, because we'll be spending less money doing things that are duplicative and so on in our communities that help drive health care up. So it'll make it less costly for the state and for private employers to provide insurance. I also think that the explicit ability of the Department of Human Services to consider what services are actually needed in hospitals, and to condition grant a certificate of need on certain things, allows the department and the process to push for providing services to people without insurance as well as people that have insurance.
Thank you. I think we need to, committee, wait for amendments. I don't need to call anyone else up, because we just need to have those amendments so that people can digest them. And remember, we only have two meetings after this one, so we need to move on.
Can I just ask one more question?
Yes.
How would you feel if we were, in order to satisfy all of the participants that would be affected by this bill, an interim study?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I would be very disappointed. I think it would be appropriate to have an interim study to look at what were the next steps. I would be delighted to participate in that, but I would urge you to take this first step now.
Madam Chair, a question and then a comment. Question to you. If this bill comes back at some point, will there be opportunity for other people to testify, simply because we've all been shut out of the process at this point?
Oh, I have had the opponents in my office explaining their views, and I told them that they need to be going to each one of the members of this committee, to as well as the proponents, in advocating for this bill. I do not know if I have the votes for this bill, and so the advocates and the opponents need to be doing their job, working with each of the members, each of the
And thank you for that, Madam. Well, I would hope that they would be able to put things on the record.
But, yes.
But my comment would be in relation to 329, which I have grave concerns over. and the nexus between that and this bill. I would suggest that if your goal is to get more government control over health care decisions, they're both moving in the same direction.
Yeah, Madam Chair. That would be my concern, Madam Chair, that is that we have too many ends out here. Mm-hmm. And certificate of need makes sense. I'm not against the fact of having a certificate of need. That is not my concern, because I really do think that we need it. But I think there needs to be coordination. We're just having too many bills up this session that have not joined forces, and somewhere along the way we need to do that. When they go to the president's office, I can imagine his reaction to that, because then so many things stand alone. And it would appear to me that there should be a coordinated effort on the part of all of you guys that are bringing new bills of this nature to the legislature, that there is some kind of partnership and some kind of coordinated effort for how we go in the future in dealing with this issue. Because my hospitals are saying to me that, oh, we don't want you to support this bill. And I'd like to be able to support progressive action toward everybody having access to health care and the lowered cost on health care. But at this particular moment, my hospitals are concerned about 329, they're concerned about 948, and there are a couple of other measures out there they're concerned about too. So, Madam Chair, if our committee is going to do anything, may I please ask you as chair of this committee that there is some coordination before we vote on any one thing.
Thank you. I really appreciate your input, Senator Carter. Any other comments? Yes, Senator Gordon.
Just a couple of thoughts. This matrix tells a story, and I don't know that we've spent the necessary time to fully understand and appreciate what the new ranking might look like should this public policy be put in place. And so I'm wondering, I guess my concern and question goes back to what Senator Carter has just said. Is this conversation taking place someplace else in the building?
Mm-hmm.
Is this a conversation that's taking place down there with the Special Committee on Health Care, the Senator Bates, Senator Westland Committee? Is this a conversation that's taking place over on the House side? Where do the streams come to come together? And then the witness, Ms. Kreider, has made the statement that that this is a public policy that will have the effect of lowering costs. That's a statement. Based on what evidence? Based on what assumptions? I mean, we haven't had that discussion. And so in order to fully accept the statement that this will lower costs, I think we need to have a more thorough discussion that unpacks the assumptions,
mm-hmm.
and that looks at some evidence that points in that direction. Now, I don't know that we're going to have time to have that discussion in this committee since we've only got two meetings left, but it needs to take place someplace. And it needs to take place, as has been stated, in alignment with the health reform, the overall health reform discussion that's taking place in the building. Otherwise, we're going to miss the mark.
Appreciate that. All right, I would encourage you to meet with Senator Gordley regarding this. We had certificate of need, and Senator Cruz and I are the only ones that really went through it last session very much in depth, and I apologize that you're not up to speed, but I know that with the hospitals and with Lynn Marie to give some more input on that particular.
The information that I'm looking for, it's not just my need for information. I'm talking about the public's need to fully understand what it is we're doing and the need to lay down a good public record. So it's not that I need to meet with Ms. Kreider. We need to have a fully, given that all the parties haven't been able to get together in the same room, given that there seems to be resistance to folks getting together for an interim study, how much of this can we flesh out while we're here in this committee, in the special committee on health care, et cetera? Am I making sense?
You bet.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that once we get the amendments, I need to have every vested interested party out there. I would like to schedule this for the 30th. I'm not sure we're going to have the amendments. Well, it's possible we could carry them. They should be done today. Okay. And what is our schedule like for Wednesday?
It's busy, but so is
Monday. Okay. All right. Well, let's just carry this over to Wednesday and see where we get on it. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, I close the work session on, the public hearing on Senate Bill 948, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 353 since we have guests. So I'm not sure we will get to 717, but I don't think we have invited guests on that one. Sorry.
Did you say that Emily said come for 717?
753.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. Colleagues, this is a bill that we have had before the legislature, I think, for 8 years now. Mr. Price, who is from Colorado, has had 3 children since we started having this bill. He was here the first time. This is a very important bill because it deals with the surgical technicians who are not licensed necessarily by hospitals to work in surgery and do very important duties. And I've said this before, and I'll use this analogy again. You can take a candy striper off the floor, put her in surgery, and make her a surgical technologist without any formal training. Now, surgical technologists are very proud of the work that they do. There are several certifying agencies, national agencies, and what we're asking is that hospitals do not hire a person who is not certified by one of the national agencies or been trained in the armed forces. There is not a general fund appropriation for this. We do have the Dash 3s, which is a licensing mechanism for funding the nurse or the surgical technicians. So I ask you to consider this, please, and to move it out, send it to the floor. With that, I will end my testimony. Mr. Price is here. He just flew in from Colorado to testify, and we have others who wish to testify on the bill. So with that, I will end my testimony. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
It's a beautiful state. I used to live in Colorado, so I know how beautiful that state is also.
Oh, I love to visit your state. I'm going to travel around a little bit after this hearing. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for your time today. My name is Ben Price, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the National Association of Surgical Technologists. The fact that I have had 3 kids since we started working on this bill is largely in testament to the fact that the pill is only 99.5% effective, and two of my kids are the 0.5%. Surgical technologists are allied health professionals that are not nurses. We've been in practice since right around the time of World War II, owing to the need during the war to develop this type of allied healthcare professional. We work in hospitals, surgery centers, and in some limited cases, doctor's offices, and our national organization was founded in 1969. The big mistake that the public and most people outside the operating room make is the assumption that everyone in the operating room is either a doctor or a nurse. There's actually a group of people working in the operating room that are and have been unregulated and have been brought into the hospital through different mechanisms over the years. But at this point, there are around 80,000 surgical technologists practicing in the United States. We believe 800 to 900 in the state of Oregon. And most of those surgical technologists now are coming out of the formal schooling system. There are over 400 accredited programs in the United States at this point. Surgical technologists establish and protect the sterile operative field in the operating room. They prepare the OR for surgery. They secure all the supplies for the surgery. And then during the actual procedure, they're in the sterile field beside the surgeon, passing instruments, performing delegated duties, and anticipating the needs of the surgeon during that procedure so that everything's ready when it's needed. They also, in some instances with further training, stand across from the surgeon and perform other tasks like tying knots, stopping bleeders, and things like that. The point there is that these are people with their hands on every surgical patient in the operating room in every case that happens in your state, often inside the surgical incision. And at this point, they're the only practitioner in that surgical field that's not regulated in some way. Our efforts here in Oregon have been a coordinated effort since we began. We started in the first year, and we found a lot of opposition from different groups because we hadn't all sat down and talked about it. Since then, we've all sat down and talked, and we've worked carefully with the Oregon Nurses Association, the Oregon State Council of Perioperative Nurses, and the National Association of Operating Room Nurses. And really what began as something that was a little bit contentious has become a larger national organized effort between our organizations. And we took the idea from Oregon several years ago, and the state of Tennessee has actually already passed it into law. What Senate Bill 353 would do is establish standards that would help to protect the public by grandfathering the existing staff of surgical technologists, but then beginning to use the national certification and graduation from accredited school as the state standard for the profession. We hope that it would be relatively revenue neutral, and we hope we can find some ways to make that happen in the best way possible. But we believe that it would enhance your already existing technical education system. What it would not do is increase the scope of practice of surgical technologists, infringe on any other professions already working in the operating room, or eliminate already practicing surgical technologists, or create a need for developing new education in your state. What it does do, though, is very important. It creates a date certain where a route of entry in the profession begins. It allows all of the people that are already working to continue working, but it creates a system for entry, a route of entry into the profession that we believe will help to protect surgical patients in your state. It doesn't leave anyone behind, and it creates an important standard of care for patients. I'd like to thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. One of those accredited institutions is at Mount Hood Community College. I actually had a person from Idaho who lived with me for the 2 years that she was trained there at Mount Hood Community College. So I'm very familiar with it, and I was very surprised that they didn't have to be certified or have a special training. And I think we've had this bill before, and always they say, well, we don't have enough surgical technologists. You're saying that this bill would grandfather anyone in. Is that correct?
Correct.
Would that, in your experience, provide a shortage then as the surgery centers are starting to become prominent all over, and we are going to be needing more surgical technologists? I'm worried about the drain, or if surgeries would not be able to be performed at this point in time if we certified, although I really personally feel that everyone in that OR should be certified.
Well, Madam Chair, we believe that the grandfather language, the way we've written it, is so broad that it would help to prevent a shortage. It would also allow, we believe, for the traveling agencies that the hospitals rely on to still function, so long as they functioned within the parameters of the law. But we have a really large feeder system of schools developed across the country now, and so we have around 6,000 new surgical technologists coming out of those programs every year. And our data shows that really will help to fill the need. I don't think we'll create a shortage.
Committee, I think that if we read the report from the Safety Commission, we would be appalled at of what is happening after surgeries where things are left inside of a patient and infections occur. And so I know that setting standards is a good thing. Just if you wanted to read that report, I think it's really an eye-opener. Thank you very much. Any
Thank
questions
you.
For him? All right. Martin Taylor?
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, this is Martin Taylor representing the Oregon Nurses Association. For the last two legislative sessions, I've also worked on a contract basis for a national organization called AORN, which is the Perioperative Nurses Specialty Organization nationally, and worked with both AORN and ONA to try to take a bill that we fundamentally shared a concern with the surgical technologists, that there were folks in the operating room setting who were not necessarily competent to perform that function and that some standard should exist, but try to direct the legislation in a way that we felt comfortable with. And we've got there. It's taken, 5 years, but we've gotten there. And as a result of that success, I've been let go by AORN because they really needed somebody here to stop something bad from happening, not to promote this legislation. As ONA, I felt pretty strongly that we don't work 5 years on anything, and then when we get to a good outcome, just walk away from the table. This is a good outcome. It is important that you have some competence among everybody in an operating room setting. I think Mr. Price did a very good job of describing it. I would also say that as an organization that represents workers for collective bargaining, we understand, too, that with a professional standard for surgical technologists, they're more likely to receive a professional wage, and that there is a value to the workers as well as to the patients that they're taking care of. I have to admit, this is not ONA's very favorite approach. I think that there was always a belief that this is a group of licensees that would fit better under the Board of Nursing, but I think that you need to look at this bill as a way of getting started in setting a standard, and that the relationship between nurses and surgical technologists has improved a great deal over the last 5 years, both in the state and nationally, and we may get to a point one day where a level of trust exists to do the bill differently. I know that the agencies themselves are a little like, well, shouldn't this go under a board? It would be very difficult to do that right now, and I think what you've got is a compromise between professions that will work, and that somewhere down the road, I hope that you do have an opportunity to revisit how we do the regulation here. So I'm the author of the Dash 1 amendments. That was the Dash 2 amendments. Those were the last amendments that AORN needed before they let me go. They make the bill a better bill from both the national and state perspective, and I'm here to answer questions.
I would like to know if the proponents of the bill have had a chance to look at the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments and if they're in agreement with that. Okay. All right. Thank you. No further questions. I'd like to ask Sarah Breckenridge from Yamhill. And Katie King. Is that the last one? Oh, and Suzanne Bauer. Have you all come up?
Hi, thank you, Senator Monsanto and the committee. My name is Sarah Breckenridge, and I am a registered nurse with over 34 years of experience in the operating room. And I thank you for this opportunity to speak in favor of Senate Bill 353. My career has included 20 years at OHSU, 13-plus years at several small hospitals in Lincoln and Yamhill counties, and I currently work as a clinical coordinator for an ambulatory surgery center in the metro area. My experience ranges from staff nurse to department manager. I represent myself and my patients. I've worked extensively with the surgical technologist colleagues throughout their process in developing this piece of legislation. Accredited academic preparation for the surgical technologist is essential for safe patient care. We work in an environment where we prepare for war and pray for peace. Patient safety is my passion, and I ask that you consider the serious nature of what my colleagues and I do in our everyday practice in the care of the surgical patient. Recently, an owner of a contract specialty surgery service approached my son at the local Starbucks store, asking him if he would be interested in working for him. He described the service and stated he would train him to do the procedures. Seth would end up bringing the supplies and equipment into the institution, prepare for the procedure, assist the physician with the procedure. I've worked with these type of services. They are brought in to do these procedures due to the expense of the supplies and equipment and the low frequency of doing these types of surgeries for the contracting institution, whether it be a hospital or surgery center. We're now having a barista becoming the expert in the room. Their understanding of sterile techniques, sterile processing, and patient care is limited. The focus of this bill is to place the responsibility of the employer to hire only qualified surgical technologists. Your constituents deserve a standard of care that is consistent whether they have their surgical procedure in a single operating room institution or in our large hospital multi-specialty operating room settings. I ask for your support as a patient advocate and as a member of the team in the operating room. I must have confidence that my coworker has an understanding of the complexities of the environment and the standards that are foundation of our combined practice. We all have a lot to do during a surgical procedure. When I am circulating, I do not have time to worry if the surgeon knows what he or she is doing. I also do not have time to keep an eye on the surgical technologist. My eye is on the patient. This is a win for everyone, and especially for the patient, who is at their most vulnerable time and trusts that everyone that they have trusted with the very essence of their life is fully prepared to care for him and her. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you. We'll end with you, Katie. Let's go ahead and have
Suzanne,
yeah.
Dear Senators, my name is Suzanne Bowen. I'm a certified surgical technologist. I work in the main OR at Kaiser Sunnyside in Michigan. I am in support of Bill 353. The main reason I feel this bill must be passed is patient safety. The OR is a place that not very many people understand. There are four roles: the surgeon, the anesthesiologist, the registered nurse in the circulating role, the surgical tech in the scrub role, or an RN that has been trained to scrub. Every role is important and requires that each person is properly trained to do their job. As a tech, I am responsible for making sure that all the instrumentation is ready, available for the surgeon, but most importantly, I handle all of it. I set up the back table. I prepare everything that is involved in the procedure with the utmost care to maintain surgical sterility. To put a person in that position without proper training is dangerous for the patient. If something becomes contaminated, which can happen by just touching a little bit too low behind, under your table to an area where your sterile field is not there anymore, an infection can occur. And that is very serious, especially now when people are becoming so resistant to so many antibiotics. You get a bad infection in your bone or just in your blood system, it's very hard to get to stop. There's still on-the-job training going on, and Bill 353 would prevent this. Bill 353 would require that only a tech who attended an accredited school could take the certification exam, and that only a certified technician could work in the state of Oregon. If you have ever had surgery, or if you ever need to have surgery in the future, I am sure you would want the person who is handling all the instruments that are going inside your body to be properly trained. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm surprised that there are no surgeons, or at least a representative from the surgeons, because usually the surgeon picks his own team. Tell me how a surgeon determines who will be work with them.
I'm doing the job.
Yes.
I'll be going back to it as soon as I'm done here. Okay. The desk is actually the person who, you know, the charge nurse is the one who assigns the rooms. And so there are times when the surgeons will go up and request a tech because a lot of times the techs are assisting them if there's not an assistant. And nothing major, but on minor cases, they'll have a tech assist holding retractors and whatnot. But it's the charge nurse who makes the determination who goes into the rooms, which one. And that's based on your training. Myself, I'm a urology lead tech at Sunnyside, so I do all the urology cases, the open cases as well as the small. And so I'm in that every day. And it just, you know, we all tend to have areas of expertise that you stay in because you become very good at just, I mean, we pretty much, I know the surgery to actually do it as the surgeon know, but I know every step in that procedure, and I know, I don't have to send my circulating nurse out of the room, which is dangerous to have them gone. They're always in the room because I've already got everything they need there. That's my job. So it's when you have somebody that's not normally in a certain area of like orthopedics or general surgery and they don't know the procedure, they're not going to have everything. And it just I don't like when the circulator's out of the room. It just becomes, if anything goes wrong, you have nobody that can make a phone call or go on the overhead speaker. You know, it's just dangerous. So
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Questions? Okay.
Good morning, members of the committee, Madam Chair. My name is Katie King, and I'm the government relations person from DHS. And I'm here in public health, and I'm here on behalf of Grant Higginson, who's the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning. And his office is in charge of the healthcare licensing and certification program. And this program licenses and certifies a number of healthcare facilities and agencies, including hospitals and ambulatory surgical centers. And the bill would require the department to revise the current hospital and ambulatory surgical rules, which address the qualifications of facility staff, adopt new rules for implementing a process for civil penalties for facilities for failing to meet the new requirements of this bill, establish a process for the submission, review, and approval of waivers based on the inability of facilities to hire qualified surgical technologists, and this is going to require ongoing monitoring by the department. Establish a process for the submission, review, and approval where hospitals may hire surgical technologists who qualify by past experience rather than certification, and provide the on-site verification during the routine inspections and complaint investigations of hospital and ambulatory surgical centers. The Dash 3 amendments address our concerns about being able to implement a fee to cover the cost of the workload, but we do want to point out that the bill doesn't contain these funds aren't included in the governor's recommended budget, and it's mentioned to charge the fees to the surgical technologist as part of this program. So I'd like to thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I know that it would take time to develop rules.
Mm-hmm.
And according to this, has an emergency clause that would have to take effect on its passage.
Mm-hmm.
If we remove that emergency clause to allow time for rules to be developed and for and then for the fee schedule to set up, would that affect at all the fiscal?
Madam Chair, I don't believe so, but I'd have to go back and talk with Grant Higginson about
okay.
that.
All right. And we don't have a fiscal, so I'd like to request a fiscal now with the two amendments, and I would like to have an amendment put in to remove the emergency clause just in case that has. And I see that Senator Morissette's staff is nodding their heads, so they'll be working with Shannon then. Any other questions for the committee? And I would like to schedule this then for the 30th. Hopefully we can.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think this bill makes a lot of sense. And I think that when we look at so many negatives happening in the operating room, that we should look to the people that are working there to give us direction. And it appears to me that we've heard it today, and so I'd really like for this bill to be passed, and we'll be supporting it. So I hope that we can get together on the fees and whatever else is necessary.
It would be nice when we request the fiscal that to get input. In fact, I would like to actually ask the who is it from Colorado again, Ben Price, if he could come and speak to fees in other states and if you could give some input there so that we can give guidance. It would be nice to know what the fees would be.
Madam Chair, at this point, we've approached legislation from several different angles, but Tennessee and South Carolina...
Oh, for the record, reintroduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Ben Price from the Association of Surgical Technologists. Tennessee passed an almost identical bill into law in 2004 that went into effect in 2006. They had a fiscal impact statement that was zero, and they've been able to work it without any fees to the surgical technologists. They just worked it into the regular hospital review process that they already do, so it's just a part of the paperwork that they were already going to look at the hospital. South Carolina is a little further along in the process than Oregon, and they have a similar fiscal impact statement that said it wouldn't add any additional cost to the state.
Do you have a comment regarding the... We're not the same as Tennessee, and so your Department of Human Services might be better funded than ours. Go ahead,
Madam Chair. You are correct. It is an issue of workload and funding, and right now the healthcare licensure and certification program can't take on any additional duties without additional funding. And I know that LFO hasn't approved the fiscal yet, but it's our understanding that it would take about a half-time person to take on these additional duties.
And so that would be to half-time to develop the rules?
Madam Chair, all of the duties outlined in the bill. And when we were initially contemplating the fiscal, we thought that there might be 200 surgical technologists in Oregon, although the experts are telling me that could be as many as 600, 800 or more, and that would reduce the cost for folks in the program.
Yes. Senator Carter.
The one thing I've noticed, other states do fund their public health. Our public health is zeroed out this time. And so I don't see how there is no way with any level of credibility or responsibility could we pass on this unfunded mandate to the public health department since they are basically paid by the feds and not by the state.
Now I'd like to ask a question of the surgical technologist. If you were required to pay a fee to be a certified surgical technologist, I know as an RN, I think I pay $85 every 2 years, which isn't very much. I don't know what would be the reaction, do you think? I know you can only speak for yourself.
Right, and I do only speak for myself. Right now, one of the things to stay certified I thought I should mention is that you're required to do CEUs, which are about 15 a year. You can get them in numerous ways by attending different programs where, you know, continuing education, just different things. And some of them are not charged to us, and some are. But I'd say to answer your question, I would be willing to pay a fee. I wouldn't want it to be hundreds of dollars a year, but I think it's that important because I have seen and I know personally people that have been asked as the unit secretary of a unit to be trained to start working as a surgical tech. It offends me some because I know what I had to do to get to where I'm at, And then I think about, I mean, I've had two C-sections. They're usually OB techs that are put in this position because of when you ask the question about shortages. That's a lot of times why the hospitals will do this. There's a shortage of people that are qualified, so they, because there's no regulations on this job, well, they just take anybody they can, and they train them, and I just think it's wrong. It's unsafe. And we've all heard about the people who end up with an infection and getting a C-section, and then their baby goes home and they stay in the hospital. Well, a lot of times that's because the person doing that C-section wasn't properly trained. That's a major abdominal surgery. So, yes, I'd be willing to pay a fee because I think it's that important.
Thank you. Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Gordon.
Going back to the emergency clause, I do not support removing the emergency clause from the bill. This is a patient safety issue.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, again, looking at the language in the emergency clause, we have those clauses for the immediate preservation of the public peace, health, and safety. An emergency is declared to exist, etc. So, no, that we need to leave that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the dash 3 amendments address our concerns about being able to charge a fee.
And, you know, even with our CNAs who don't have as much responsibility as our technologists, they pay, I think we're just raising their fee to $75. So if something in that category, is that right, Marty, about 75 for CNA? Something like that. Well, you guys helping to pay for it, I thought you might know. So they're going to be paying now that this has come to our attention. So it would appear to me that something in that arena would be a fair.
Wonderful. Yes, one more comment.
I just had one more comment, and it's just an invitation, and I've talked to some of the people at my hospital, but if ever you want to educate yourselves and come as a guest to the OR and just take a tour and be able to see what exactly, if you saw the amount of instruments and the amount of stuff you have to open sterilely to just really get an impact of how important this job is and what we really do, because the OR is a secret place because of HIPAA and all the rules with that. People can't even bring their children in from those parent days where you can bring your kid to school or bring your kid to school or to work.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I was just going to offer to anybody, if you ever want to come in there, we can make arrangements so you can really see what we do as a job. You couldn't come in the room when the patient's there because that would be breaking HIPAA, but you could most certainly come in and just see what we do. So,
thank you very, very much.
Offer.
Well, I think this is extremely important, Bill. I think Senator Morissette's staff has got some direction, and we will get a fiscal, and hopefully I would like to schedule it for Wednesday just in case we get amendments back. If not, it will be the 30th on our last day because I feel this is a good bill. All right. With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 353 and just briefly open a public hearing on 717, scope of practice. And we won't call anyone up, but I want the public to, or the committee, to look at the three amendments that are before you to just sort of start thinking about this. This is scope of practice where we would have anyone who wants to change their scope of practice would submit an application, and then a committee would be established, and recommendations would be made from that committee, and then that recommendation would come to us. There was a work group, and the three amendments, the dash ones, leaves everything intact except, the bill remains the same, except that it would be repealed after 2012 to see if it was working or not. The second amendments would put, instead of the Board of Medical Examiners being the convener, it would be put into the
Center for Evidence-Based Policy, which is located at the Oregon Health Science University. And then the third one would be, and everything else stays the same, would put this group in with the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. And I just wanted you to be aware of the amendments so you can start thinking about that, and hopefully we'll be able to address this bill on Wednesday.
With public testimony?
Definitely with public testimony.
Amendments. Okay.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 717, and we're adjourned.